You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We hear from higher ed on tax reform in Congress.
The tax legislation is rushed. It is hurting the very people that we want to get more education so that they can have more options in life.
Michigan could soon be the only state in the country which does not require lawmakers to file financial disclosures.
It's not because they think it's a particularly bad idea. They just think the need for financial disclosure has been exaggerated.
Are Democrats taking the black vote for granted?
We got to start having a conversation and not just coming around during election time.
We'll hear about a new book on slavery in Detroit. And we have an artisan of Michigan. Welcome to Planet Marimba. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In the middle of the sexual harassment allegations against Democratic Senator Al Franken, Republican Representative Trent Franks, and Michigan's Democratic Representative John Conyers, all of whom plan to resign, another allegation was made. During a rally for Congressman Conyers in Detroit, clergy, state legislators, and other supporters felt Democratic leaders were treating Conyers differently. They felt the Democratic Party was making decisions about their representative without due process and without consulting constituents of Michigan's 13th congressional district. One state legislator said the rush to judgment by leading Democrats such as Nancy Pelosi revealed the party felt African Americans are disposable, that their votes are taken for granted. Jonathan Kinlock is the Democratic Party chair of the 13th Congressional District, and he joins us now. This is not the first time this issue has been brought up. In fact, last year, during the campaign, then-Republican candidate Donald Trump declared the Democratic Party has failed and betrayed the African American community. What are African American voters telling you?
Well, initially when these allegations surfaced, you know, folks were, of course, surprised and quite upset with some of the rumbling that went on, and particularly when they came out, folks were immediately asking for the congressman to resign. Many people in the district were familiar with some of the rumblings of names that may or may not have been involved in this, and so it was like, why aren't they giving the congressman due process? And then after you had the Detroit Free Press asking for his resignation, and then you had a number of local congresspersons, Democrats in particular, asking for his resignation, while they were not asking for the resignation of Senator Al Franken, it was quite problematic. People are like, we have to say something. We have to at least call for due process for the congressman at minimum.
You mentioned that nobody had called for Franken at that time on Monday, possibly not, but certainly women Democratic senators have come out since then. Has that changed the way you look at this at all?
It changed the way we look at it from the standpoint that they should have been calling for his resignation just as quick as they called for the congressman's resignation based upon the allegations. It's not to say that the allegations should be taken any less serious than they actually should be, but it's just everyone should have a right to address their accuser in a proper, impartial forum. And so that was basically the concern in a lot of the calls that I were getting. I mean, why are they jumping all on the congressman without letting him have an opportunity to even respond?
I want to talk about the Democratic Party in general. Does the party listen, and when I say the party, I mean state leaders or federal leaders, listen to or consult with local Democratic organizers in districts such as yours or in the 14th district?
That's interesting you say that, because I was talking with some of the stakeholders in the 13th district, and I was going to actually reach out to Nancy Pelosi to talk with her about that whole issue of her making a determination, calling for his resignation without reaching out to, at minimum, the local party to get our sentiment, to get our thoughts. No, they did not. Even now, I understand that the office of the former congressman is still open. I understand that that office is operating on behalf of the 13th Congressional District in a nonpartisan fashion, but there's no formal communication from at least Pelosi or anyone within the Democratic folks in Washington to let us know how to move forward.
How about in the state? When we've got several state candidates running around right now, are they, to your mind, taking the black vote for granted, or are they working with you, talking with you, wanting to make sure that they understand your issues and how you might help?
Let me say this. It's still early yet. you would think that people would have been more in contact with the 13th and the 14th district, but I can only speak for the 13th district. I have not had a conversation with Gretchen Whitmer, but, you know, we've had other candidates who have come into the district. And matter of fact, Dr. Abdul El Sayed is very engaged and an officer within the 13th congressional district. We also had Bill Cobbs to come and address the district, but it's still early to talk about folks actually coming through the district.
What about 2016? What's the history of the Democratic Party working with African-American voters in Michigan?
When you talk about 2016, that was a very different sort of situation that I hadn't seen in recent elections. The state Democratic Party stays in touch with us. The state party leadership, definitely I'm in touch with them often throughout the week regarding political issues and just operational issues. But when you talk about the candidates and the resources for 2016, that was ran through Brooklyn. So I do not think that it was a much of a real focus on grassroots and grassroots engagement until the last 2 weeks of the campaign. I think Hillary Clinton's campaign pretty much thought, even as the state party and those stakeholders in Michigan were saying, no, we need more effort. I was in meetings where they were asking for more resources and more attention into the black community. But Hillary Clinton, basically, her campaign, from what I understood and what I saw, basically micromanaged Michigan and particularly the city of Detroit from Brooklyn. I did not understand it, and that was something I think that impacted her loss.
What does the Democratic Party need to do to keep African-American voters engaged in politics and turning out at the polls?
One thing, in my opinion, that state Democratic Party has learned, as well as the Democratic National Committee, to put resources out early to begin to have conversations with the black voters and just voters across the state of Michigan about issues that are important to them, finding out what they want the party to be representing at the state and also the federal level. We got to start having a conversation and not just coming around during election time, becoming more relevant, speaking to issues that are local. And so we got to become more engaging, have that conversation inside of folks' homes now and not just wait till election time. And that's something we've started this year in which I'm seeing a lot of positive response from.
Jonathan Kinlock is the Democratic Party chair of Michigan's 13th Congressional District. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Congress wants to present a final version of tax reform to President Donald Trump by Christmas. Many public and private colleges are hoping there are some changes made before the legislation reaches the president's desk. In a statement, the president of the Association of American Universities recently outlined some of the major concerns. Mary Sue Coleman joins us to talk about those concerns. Members of Congress backing tax reform see tax reform as pro-growth and desperately needed. You argue this can't be pro-growth if a lot of students and their families can no longer afford college. What is in this tax reform legislation that would cost students more than they're currently paying?
There are a number of elements here that we believe would really make college less affordable for average American families, and so we're very concerned about it. But let me give you an idea about a few of them. There's a proposal to tax the tuition waivers that graduate students receive, and the impact of this would be to double or triple the income tax that these young people pay, and most of them on a barely livable wage as it is for the work they do for the university. So we believe that would be a very negative effect on graduate education.
Right. One of the examples I saw was, a grad student might be earning $30,000 a year, but also getting a $50,000 tuition waiver, but would be taxed in the future as if making $80,000 a year.
That's the essence of the problem, because they never see that income because it's actually paid to the university. And it would simply make it impossible for many, many students to go to graduate school unless they had an independent source of wealth. So we're very much opposed to that provision. We're also opposed to the idea of taxing employer educational benefits. Now, employers are able under the law to offer up to about $5,280 to employees so that they can further their education. This is currently not taxed, either to the employee or the employer. If it were, again, it's another impediment for getting a more highly educated workforce, and we think that that's really negative for the global competitiveness of the country, you know, and for growth of the economy. And then the other element that we are very concerned about, and that is the proposal to tax university endowments. Currently, it's for private universities, but we believe that if this were enacted, that it would move quickly to public universities like the University of Michigan and Michigan State University. And we believe that this would be, you know, very harmful because these endowments provide scholarships for students. They provide funds for faculty research. And if there's a tax on it, it's going to the federal government, then fewer funds will be available. And we think that's a big negative.
You suggest the worst aspect of this tax reform package might be the increase in federal debt. Of course, the Republicans and the president say the economic stimulus caused by the tax cuts for corporations will more than offset predictions of the estimated $1.4 trillion in debt over the next 10 years. Your concern is that this will damage investments in research, higher ed, infrastructure, and other drivers of economic growth. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I don't have any evidence from the past that massive tax cuts like this have really helped with economic growth. And so in the absence of evidence, then I am highly, highly skeptical. Already, I think we're hearing murmurings from Congress that if we add $1.5 trillion to the national debt, we're going to have to start cutting social programs. What are the social programs? Medicare will be at top of the list. Social Security will be next. So I think when you create these new massive deficits, the only thing that the Congress then can do is to go back, if they're not willing to impose new taxes, is to go back and cut the programs that the federal government supports. And that's going to affect a lot of hardworking Americans. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult for people to advance economically. And so I do not see this as a massive stimulus to the economy, no.
Well, you wrote that there should be some kind of tax reform along with entitlement reform, that Medicaid and Social Security and Medicare that you were talking about. So what do you think Congress should be doing instead of the path it's apparently taking?
Well, I do think that there are policies that the Congress could take for tax reform, broad-based tax reform. I mean, there are a lot of entities that now don't pay their fair share of taxes, but we need to look at it in a way that will really broaden the base, make our taxes more compatible with global sort of norms. I mean, I understand all that, but this seems to me the tax legislation is rushed. It is hurting the very people that we want to get more education so that they can have more options in life. And I just do not see why this needs to be done before Christmas without a clear discussion about what it's going to do to the broad sector of the American people.
Mary Sue Coleman is the president of the Association of American Universities and, of course, past president of the University of Michigan. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after a short break. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There are accepted historical facts, in air quotes, which do not hold up to closer scrutiny. One of those is that slavery was something that happened in the South, not the North. That is simply wrong. A new book examines examples of Northern slavery, focusing on the early days of Detroit. The book's title is The Dawn of Detroit, A Chronicle of Slavery and Freedom in the City of the Straits, and the author is Tia Miles. Welcome.
Hi, Lester.
This book, I think, is a fascinating history of Detroit on its own, but it thoroughly documents how the city from the first days was built and became prosperous in part because of the labor of enslaved people when it was a French outpost. The slaves then, few of them were actually black slaves. Most of them were indigenous people, and they were women. How did that develop?
It developed because native people in the region actually had their own system of captive taking, in which nations that were at war with one another would try to capture women and children and incorporate those individuals into the tribe that had taken them. When the French came, they actually adopted this practice and encourage Native people to trade women and children to them.
Hmm. So Detroit was held by the French and the British and finally the United States, and the U.S. government of the Northwest Territory, as it was called then, had a weak prohibition against slavery. But with the government made up of former Virginia plantation families, people like William Henry Harrison, who later became president briefly, he was governor of the Indiana Territory, which included Michigan. There were plenty of loopholes. How common was slavery in Detroit after the Revolutionary War?
Well, that's a thing that's really surprising, I think, for a lot of people, because we tend to think of our region, the Northwest Territory, the Midwest, as a free space, because we know that slavery was officially prohibited by the Congress.
Officially.
Officially, but not on the ground. And that prohibition included loopholes such that people who already lived here, that included French settlers and British settlers, could continue to hold their enslaved people. And new Americans coming in were able to rent those individuals, lease those individuals, and marry into slaveholder families.
Speaking of families, the figures you cover in this book, it's such detail and it's names that we recognize as Detroit streets today. I mean, Woodward, Hull, Brush. How did these leaders perpetuate slavery in the city?
Well, each individual that you just named had a different kind of relationship to slavery. It was a really complex picture. And that complexity comes in part from the fact that we did have layered generations of slaveholders. So the French were a different kind of slaveholder than the British, who were different from the Americans. Some of the oldest French families did own enslaved people, both Black and Native enslaved people, and they held them as forced laborers. Elijah Brush, whose name you mentioned, he did have enslaved people in his household. He did indenture enslaved people, but his relationship to them was a little bit different. In fact, he tried to argue for the freedom of an enslaved family.
And he was a judge, a lawyer, and a pretty successful lawyer, too.
Yes.
So it is complicated. It's intertwined because you've got these different cultures in this one city. Mm-hmm. Some of them are slaveholders. Some of them are not slaveholders, but, as you said, lease people for labor from their slaveholders. But what I'm really wondering is how large of a segment of society were enslaved people when we're talking about Detroit? I guess it depends on the time.
It absolutely does depend upon the time. The biggest time period for Detroit slaveholding was right around the Revolutionary War period. And that's a time when you still had multiple layers of slaveholders in the city. So you had many French people who were still here. You had British military officers and merchants who were here. And you also had British officers and Native American allies going down into the U.S. South, especially Kentucky and those border states, and capturing enslaved people, bringing them back to Detroit, which was a military hub for the British, and distributing them among Native people and also the British. So there was a surge in that period, and the number got to be around 300.
In a city of?
Approximately 2,300.
So that's a pretty substantial percentage of the
population. It is. It's a small community at the time.
One of the things I found really interesting is France abolished slavery in 1794, and I don't think we think of French-held Canada, our Canadians, as slaveholders. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of slavery in Windsor and how that worked with Detroit right across the river?
Well, Canada used to be a French territory. It was New France. And France experimented with slavery in its colonies in the Americas. So we can think of the Caribbean, for instance, where sugar plantations were an important part of the French economy. In the north of us, slavery was also tried out. And French leaders in New France made sure to declare to merchants and settlers that slavery would be legal in the Northern Territory. In 1709, an edict was read aloud in the major French cities explaining that both Native American and African-descended slaves could be held.
You go into quite a bit of detail about the hierarchy of race, and it evolved, especially when Southern people started to come into the Detroit area. Tell me about that evolution or devolution.
Well, I think that we often tend to believe that racial progress goes in a certain direction. It goes in a line from being negative to being more positive over time. But we actually see the opposite in Detroit, and we see the opposite in many places in the United States. There tends to be a pattern in which racial ideas were much more fluid in the earlier periods and start to harden over time. And in the case of slavery in Detroit, it's actually when the Americans come in, again, during the U.S. Revolution, that we start to see very clear and vehement ideas about Native people being red savages and Black people being a lower order of human being.
One of the passages I found interesting was a rule regarding a farmer's market. You wrote, tavern keepers were prohibited from allowing any miners, apprentices, servants, or Negroes to set drinking in their houses at any time or to have strong drink without special order and allowances of their parents or their masters. Note that the word slave is not used in that passage at all, but what does a rule like that tell you as a historian?
That is such a crucial moment. I'm glad you brought that out, Lester, because one of the things that it shows is the care with which Detroiters wrote their laws so as to avoid articulating the reality of slavery. Because officially, slavery is not legal in this region. But on the ground, it's absolutely being practiced. So instead of having what we would recognize as slave codes, they have these more generalized laws, like the one that you just read, that classes all kinds of subject people together. What happened in Detroit is that when an enslaved person committed an infraction, that person's master paid the price, so paid a fine, for instance.
You write about a woman named Elizabeth Dennison. Why did you feel it was important to tell her story?
Lisette Dennison, and that was her nickname, Lisette. She was known by that, by her family members. She really was an incredible figure in Detroit's history. She lived through incredible changes in the city and in Michigan because she was born as an enslaved girl. And she ended up getting her freedom through a dramatic way. Her family is actually the one whose freedom Elijah Brush defended in the Michigan Supreme Court. And the family ended up getting a mixed decision by Judge Woodward. Some of them would be freed. Some of them would still be enslaved. And so they ran away together across the border into Ontario, Canada. So Lisette got her freedom in a very dramatic way. And she and her siblings ended up being border crossers. They lived back and forth across Michigan and Ontario over the course of their lives. And Lisette, a woman who was born enslaved, ended up becoming an incredibly savvy businesswoman. She saved her money that she earned as a domestic worker over many years. She bought property in Pontiac and in Detroit. She rented her property out, and she was able to save enough that she could leave a large sum of money to found a church on Gross Isle.
You note that there's not a lot in the way of scholarly works on slavery in the North, and the documentation of the period is limited. How hard was it to find and make sense of the historical record?
I'm someone who was born in the Midwest. I've lived here for quite a long time in different states. To me, the Midwest really did stand for a place of freedom. This project began, actually, with a study of the Michigan abolitionist Laura Smith Haviland. I was researching her life, and in fact, I talked about her on this show a few years ago. And it was only then, when I delved more deeply into Michigan history about abolitionism, that I realized that slavery was a real and concrete and long-lived reality here.
One of the things I was fascinated, I grew up in Illinois, and I was an adult before somebody told me about black laws in Illinois, which basically perpetuated slavery as well. What should the history of slaveholding in Detroit tell us about our world today?
I think there are so many things that we can learn from this story. One is that we live in an incredibly complicated social arena, in a layered context, where we can't assume that we know the history of a person or their group by looking at them. This story included so many surprises for me, not just the fact that Detroiters held enslaved people, but also the fact that some Detroiters actually fought against slavery. They fought against anti-black racism, and they felt that slaveholding was against their American identity. So I think that we can learn about the diversity of the places where we live and about the struggles that our forebears went through and about the really creative ways in which multiple people actually joined forces to fight against injustice.
Your book comes out at an interesting time. We've recently seen an increase in bigotry, white supremacy. I wonder what kind of response you're getting to this book.
It's a difficult time indeed. And in Michigan, on our campuses, we're seeing so many distressing expressions of prejudice against different groups. I have to say, though, that the response to this book has been very positive and very open-minded. I've been hearing from students who are from the Detroit area and also from people who've lived there their whole lives and who are older people that they are really glad to know about this history. One man told me that he even feels like it can introduce a process of healing for him. And I think that what he meant is that when people know something is wrong, but the reality of the history feels like it's shrouded, they can't actually pinpoint the problem and start to work towards solutions. And I've also heard from people who are the descendants of slaveholders. This has been really interesting to me and quite a surprise, but I appreciate their honesty in emailing me and coming up to me to talk about this. these individuals are struggling. They have said that they always thought that their ancestors were big founders of the city. They talked about feeling proud. These are people who have streets named after their family. And now they're dealing with confronting this other facet of their family's histories. But they are looking at it with eyes wide open. They are saying they want to learn more about the evidence. They want to know if their ancestors actually ever freed anyone and what they can do now to overturn this legacy.
I've got one more question. It's about the title, City of the Straits. Why did you use that particular moniker in the title?
I used it because it was really a pleasure to go back and look at some of these old histories of Detroit published in the early 1900s that emphasize the strait. I mean, the Detroit River is a strait. Detroit is a city that is wholly dependent on that river. It was such poetic language, and it had a double meaning. On the one hand, it refers to the waterway. On the other hand, it refers to the dire straits and the difficult constraints that Detroiters had to face in the early period.
Taya Miles is the author of The Dawn of Detroit, A Chronicle of Slavery and Freedom in the City of the Straits. She's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me, Lester.
Our series, Artisans of Michigan, takes us to Plymouth this time. We're at Planet Marimba, the workshop of Matt Kazmierski. It's actually the garage at his home. Right now he's working on a practice marimba, which basically is a scaled-back marimba, no resonator, which makes it quieter.
My friend's mom gave me their old marimba, and I did the same thing. I took the resonators off, and it worked fantastically. My neighbors didn't complain, and I got to practice as much as I wanted.
The real trick to making a marimba is making wood bars that are in tune when you strike them, and it's not easy.
And so every bar you make, you kind of know what you're getting into, and sometimes they agree with you, and sometimes you just have to keep on remaking bars and remaking bars.
Sure, I mean, you're dealing with an organic material. It's going to be a little imprecise, it sounds like.
It's very imprecise, usually.
Each piece of wood has its own character. As Kazmierski gets closer to the size and shape he needs, he uses his ear and a scope to test what he needs to do to get the sound he needs. So he strikes the wood.
Like that. And then you have this harmonic, which is two octaves above. And then you've got a third and an octave above that, which should be somewhere around there. So this one's kind of flat right now. So I would have to tune it right here and there.
So everybody understands, he just hit the same piece of wood with three different kinds of mallets and different places on the wood. And the only way you can tune it is to actually remove material, sand it.
Yes, and once you go too far, it becomes firewood.
And that wood is not cheap. A great deal of the price of a marimba are the materials. Maybe $3,000 of a $7,000 marimba.
Right, so this same bar is probably 30 cents lower than a D. And so the fundamental is now 50 cents flat. The first harmonic is 35 cents flat. And then that third is 50 cents flat. So I got to take that second harmonic down without messing up the other two.
This is as much art as it is mechanics and, of course, experience. When I visited, he was making his 63rd marimba.
So now they're all exactly D minus 50.
And they're not all the same. Marimba players sometimes ask for extremes, such as a marimba which goes two octaves lower than is typical. Kazmierski does all the labor himself. He's a band director at a middle school, so he builds these instruments on weekends and summers.
It's a theme song I hear on some NPR program. I forget which one it is.
You can imagine big manufacturers don't have a lot of money after materials and paying skilled workers.
Probably a very narrow margin of profit when you're making lots of marimbas. And we don't know how much rosewood is left. It's it's a market that's going to kick us in the butt pretty soon.
Now, does that bother you that your wood's from a rainforest?
Yeah. And that more and more I'm making marimbas out of alternative materials.
Such as?
Padauk. And I've also experimented with other native woods, like sassafras works pretty good. Osage orange works all right. But if you want a high quality marimba, you have to use Honduran rosewood. There is no alternative. And so I'm making one rosewood marimba this year, and the other ones are Padauk. And the rosewood that I'm using was actually taken off of, most of it was taken off of an older instrument.
There are not a lot of people making marimbas in the U.S. Kazmierski has trained a few people, and one of them is now making marimbas in another state. Matt Kazmierski of Planet Marimba, another artisan of Michigan making magic in his garage. We found today's artisan through the Michigan Traditional Arts Program of the Michigan State University Museum. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The state's largest mental health authority is having trouble finding its next CEO. And it's calling attention to some of the chronic problems within the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority. That authority serves nearly 80,000 people with severe mental illnesses, developmental disabilities, and substance use disorders. It oversees a budget of more than $700 million in Medicaid funds. The agency is now being called out for wasting too much of that money. I'm here with Tracy Samilton, who's been reporting on these developments. So the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority chose a new CEO. Who was it?
Willie Brooks, and he currently works at the Oakland Mental Health Authority.
But Brooks is not the new CEO. What happened?
No, he is not. There were contract negotiations, and at some point during those negotiations, things fell apart, and he withdrew his name.
So the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority chose another person for CEO. Who was that?
And that was Joy Calloway, and she works at an agency called New Center Community Services, and her organization is one of the groups that the authority found out had been overbilling and owed them money.
Well, that doesn't look good. I understand that the county stepped in.
Yes, Warren Evans sent letters to the authority, and he, keep in mind, he recommends people to be board members, but he sent a letter and then another sort of more stern letter. I really mean it this time. I don't want you to hire Joy Calloway because of this conflict.
So she withdrew from the hiring process.
She did indeed.
I understand that is not the only example of overbilling, that there's another group that might have overbilled even more.
Yeah, by up to $20 million over the years. This is a group called ICA, and they were caught padding their bills by 2%. When they found out, the CEO then, Tom Watkins, wanted to get the money back. The authority board members stepped in and said, no, we're only going to make them go back a year of what they owe.
So why are they doing this?
You know, I have talked to a lot of people for the story on background and on the record, the few who felt that they could be on the record. And many people think it's just maintaining relationships. We don't want to rock the boat here. Everybody has a relationship with everybody else, and let's just keep going as is. Let's keep the status quo. It's too much trouble to rock the boat. I don't know.
But why are people unwilling to talk to you? I don't get that.
Okay, so that I can tell you for sure. It's because they're afraid of retaliation by the authority. I spoke to Jeff DeLay. He is one of the few people who could talk to me on the record. He's the former CEO, COO of the authority, and he told me people have too much to lose.
And I would say, why don't you go on the record? You know, it's an open meeting. And they all just kind of looked at me, you know, like us from Mars, because the biggest fear is if you go on record against the board, you're going to lose your contract.
Who leads the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority Board?
Herbert Smitherman. He is a physician who works for Wayne State University Physicians Group.
Has he explained why the overbilling was forgiven or why the board would want somebody affiliated with that organization to be the CEO of the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority?
We reached out multiple times asking Dr. Smitherman to be part of the story and to agree to an interview, and those requests were declined.
So if money's wasted or missing, who gets hurt by this? What happens to the people who are actually supposed to receive these services?
They get fewer services. We've got 80,000 people. Some of them are severely mentally handicapped. Some of them have developmental disorders, substance abuse disorders. They need these services desperately. And the less money that the authority claws back, that's less money that goes down the chain.
Claws back, you mean like when they overbilled?
That's right. If they don't go back and get that money back, they have less money to give to the people who are taking care of the people who need services.
So if the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority Board, with a budget of $730 million in Medicaid funding each year, is suspected of wasting money, taxpayer money, has the state of Michigan been looking into this?
They have, to a limited degree. I did speak to Stacey Sampson. She heads the ethics division within the State Office of Inspector General. And she said, to a certain extent, these are decisions that we let the board do. And then when I told her about these conflicts of interest that a lot of people were talking about and these overbillings and, even some suggestions that people were billing things they shouldn't have been billed, she told me a lot of it was new to her.
Now that you've brought these other instances to my attention, we will reach out to Detroit Wayne to obtain additional information and determine what, if any, action should be taken.
So where are we now? Do they have a CEO for the authority?
They have an interim CEO, somebody that has stepped up from within the organization to take that role.
But they're still trying to hire one.
They're back to the drawing board, essentially, yes.
That's Tracy Samilton, who's continuing to look into some apparent irregularities at the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority. Looking forward to your reporting on this.
Thank you. Me too.
Another example of Michigan's lack of government transparency was pointed out this week. Here to talk about that are Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate. He joins us by Skype. And Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Hi there.
Hello.
Hey, Lester.
I was reading this week the Associated Press and the Center for Public Integrity looked into and found examples around the country of state lawmakers voting on bills that ended up benefiting their own business interests. The AP reported in 47 states those conflicts of interest were easily found because almost everywhere lawmakers had to disclose their occupation and their income or their business associations. I mean, that's real transparency. Michigan does not require those disclosures. Ken, what kind of discussions, if any, were there on this issue when you were a member of the legislature?
Well, I think, there have been discussions about this for a long time. The earliest discussions that I remember were in the early 90s when I was still in the state house. And I think a good question and a fair question is why haven't legislative leaders, particularly Republican leaders, advanced this over the years? And the answer is it's not because they think it's a particularly bad idea. They just think the need for financial disclosure has been exaggerated, frankly, and that the positive impacts have been exaggerated. And that on top of that, I think they then feel a little stampeded into doing it. And so they've resisted over the years and rather than just sort of acquiesce. So I think that, frankly, is the reason why it hasn't happened.
Yeah, that's the Republican view. Vicki, did you and your Democratic colleagues ever discuss this while you were at the Capitol?
Yes, and in fact, we introduced a package of bills in 2009, we introduced them again in 2011, and we introduced them again in 2013 when I was in the legislature. And they included several things. One was a financial disclosure statement. This went a little further than I think was necessary, but certainly if you run for Congress, and you run for federal office, you have to disclose your financial interests so that people know that you may be voting on something where you own a major stake. For example, in Michigan, we're home to the automakers, and it would be highly likely that a Ford, General Motors, or Chrysler employee would be serving in the state legislature and be voting on things that impact the auto industry. And that should be disclosed. We should certainly know that. If you own a lot of shares of AT&T and you vote on AT&T bills, we should know that. But that's been turned down every time we introduced it. But there's a lot of other things that deal with transparency that Michigan has avoided dealing with, including Freedom of Information Act requests for the state legislature. Those bills finally did pass the House this year for both the legislature and for the governor and the executive branch. But they're sitting in the Senate, and the Senate Majority Leader has promised no action on those bills.
Back in 2011, I and a colleague at Michigan Radio found that at that point, at least one out of three legislators owned a business and would benefit from the big tax reform that was being pushed by Governor Snyder that year and passed. At the time, the Center for Ethics and Government at the National Conference of State Legislatures told us that these kinds of laws usually come in response to a big scandal. Ken, is it going to take a scandal before the legislature starts being more transparent and requires some kind of financial disclosure by lawmakers?
Well, Lester, Michigan historically in the legislature, when I say historically, I'm saying the last 30 years, has been relatively scandal-free compared to some other states.
Well, that's because we don't know who might be involved in something.
Well, but the scandals, legislative scandals around the country rarely involve sort of conflict of interest. It's really issues like lobbyist bribes and things like that. And back to your point, though, no, I don't think it's a conflict of interest for a legislator who has a business to vote on a business tax cut. I mean, I'm a homeowner. I have property taxes. Is it a conflict of interest that I vote on a property tax cut, or I pay sales taxes? Is there a conflict that I vote on a sales tax cut? I mean, you wouldn't be able to vote on anything.
But we can look at tax records and see property tax records and see what you paid. And we know about that. That's transparent. It's not the same thing.
Well, I'm not going to get in a big argument over this. I think transparency is generally good. Disclosure is generally good. I just think on the issue you started the show with about financial disclosure, the reason it hasn't happened in Michigan is generally because legislative leaders, admittedly, primarily Republican, have just not been convinced that it has the kind of value that some advocates say it has. And that's an arguable question. But and so they've just decided they're not going to do it. Now, I also will say, Lester, I think it's going to happen. You're not going to have 47 states require it, and then at some point in time, Michigan be the lone holdout. But that's really why it hasn't happened up to this point.
Vicki, the AP reports the other two states that don't require financial disclosures of legislators. One, Vermont, will start requiring disclosure reports next year. And the other, Idaho, has a proposal to require disclosures going to the full legislature. So Michigan could soon be the only state in the union which does not require financial disclosures of legislators. What does that say about Michigan?
Michigan is going backward when it comes to opening up its Records Act and ethical practices. The governor signed a package of bills earlier this last year that allowed dark money, undisclosed funds, to flow into campaigns. And it impacted local races this year. So there were thousands of dollars being pumped into the Royal Oak City Council race by unknown developers that wanted to buy a city council. So I think eventually the public is going to say enough is enough and we're going to have to do something. But I do want to point out something that we talked about when we were talking about voting on taxes and business taxes and all of those things. The real problem here is not that we voted on those things. It's when a legislator has a special interest in the legislation above and beyond every other legislator or above and beyond every other resident in the state of Michigan. So let me give you an example of something that worked well in Michigan. While we don't have a requirement, when I was in the legislature, we passed the non-smoking bill, which was great. And so you can go into restaurants and bars and everything. Well, one of the legislators on the Democratic side of the aisle, Mike Huckabee, owned a bar and restaurant, and he would be disproportionately impacted by that legislation because he was a bar owner, and not every other member of the legislature was a bar owner or a restaurant owner. So Mike stood up and he invoked a conflict of interest rule and did not vote on that legislation. He happened to believe in the legislation, but as a bar and restaurant owner, he felt he shouldn't vote for it. And it passed fine, but he stood up and said, I have a disproportionate ethical conflict with this piece of legislation, and I'm not going to vote on it. If there was an auto dealer that still owned an auto dealer practice and was voting on legislation to eliminate the sales tax on new cars, that should require that person to stand up and say, I have a disproportionate interest in that. So clearly, we vote on things that affect us every single day, but it's, do we have a disproportionate interest in that vote?
Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Good to talk to both of you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
As you're probably aware, it's been quite a hectic news week here in Michigan. But of all the stories bouncing around the media echo chamber, without a doubt, my favorite Michigan-centric news story of the week? The failed implosion of the Pontiac Silverdome. Now, to be honest, it really wasn't the failed implosion itself that I enjoyed, but rather the scores of supposed Facebook events created to help bring the rest of the Silverdome down. And mind you, people took time to make these, most with a pretty funny graphic. Here's just a few in no particular order. Body slam Andre the Giant until the Silver Dome falls down. Everyone bring a fan and aim it towards the Silver Dome. Help the Kool-Aid Man knock down the Silver Dome. Everyone dress like 11 and scream at the Silver Dome until it explodes. Listener note, I don't even know what the 11 reference refers to, but I'm assuming it's Scanners-esque. Roast a large turkey in the Silver Dome. Pray the Silver Dome away. Do donuts and two-step around the Silver Dome until it collapses. Feed the Silver Dome Krabby Patties until it explodes. Pour jet fuel on the rest of the Silver Dome. Watch Sharknado finish the Silver Dome. Cheering the Silver Dome on because it's no quitter. Hashtag Silver Dome Strong. Crash Mustangs into the Silver Dome to knock it down. March around the Pontiac Silver Dome for 7 days until it collapses. Silver Dome headed back to the home planet going away party. Encase the Silver Dome into a big plastic bubble and turn it into Biodome. And finally, and probably most appropriately, Lions play Silver Dome one last time to finish off the bombing.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
We'll be right back.